Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key. Joining me this evening is Joe King on remote. We can also be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet and on WBAI 99.5 FM radio in New York, and WBAI.org live streaming on the Internet at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. AT&T's mobile subscribers in some U.S. states were not able to make 911 emergency calls last Wednesday, leading to many complaints from police departments and emergency agencies in various parts of the country. The FCC received these reports of widespread AT&T 911 call outages, and they are investigating. Mobile users in at least 14 states and Washington, D.C. were not able to call 911 for a few hours last Wednesday night, as reported by the New York Times. The FCC has previously fined service providers for outages. In July 2015, for example, the agency reached a $17.5 million settlement with T-Mobile USA, resolving an investigation into two separate but related 9/11 service outages that occurred on the company's national network in 2014, and together lasted nearly 3 hours, preventing T-Mobile customers from reaching first responders when making wireless 9/11 calls. The outage on Wednesday will likely give momentum to plans to upgrade the current 911 system to a next-generation 911 system that will allow people reporting emergencies to send text messages and video and images when reporting an emergency. My recommendation, at least for now, put the non-911 numbers that you would normally use for a local emergency into your cell phone in case it happens again. There's a police department, fire department, hospital, and anyone else you can think of. The FBI has a number of paid informants. Some of these informants apparently work at Best Buy, Geek Squad by day, government informants by, well, almost by day. According to court records, a Geek Squad technician was an FBI informant. He reported he had accidentally located on a computer to be repaired child pornography. He notified his boss, also an FBI informant, who alerted another FBI informant at Best Buy as well as the FBI that this occurred. The images met the definition of child pornography and was tied to a series of illicit pictures known as the Jenny. Not necessarily a problem considering companies performing computer electronic device repairs are legally required to report and if they discover child porn to law enforcement. The difference here is the paycheck. This Geek Squad member had been paid $500 for digging around the customer's computers and reporting his findings to the FBI. That changes the motivation from legal obligation to a chance to earn extra cash by digging around in files, not essentially to the repair work at hand. More of a problem is the FBI's tactic. While it possibly could have simply pointed to the legal obligation that Best Buy has to report discovered child porn, it proactively destroyed this argument by apparently trying to cover up the origin of the investigation as well as a couple of warrantless searches. Setting aside the issue of whether the search of the computer constituted an illegal search by private individuals acting as government agents, the FBI undertook a series of dishonest measures in hopes of building a case, according to defense attorney. Searches of the computer were conducted without obtaining necessary warrants. Private searches are acceptable, but the introduction of cash payments, as well as the FBI having an official liaison with Best Buy, suggests that the searches aren't really private. Instead, the FBI appears to be using private searches to route around warrant requirements. That's not permissible, and even the FBI's belief that going after the worst of the worst isn't going to be enough to salvage these warrantless searches. In addition to these problems, the file discovered by the Best Buy tech was in unallocated spaces. In other words, it was not in the directory, something that points to almost nothing legally speaking. The Jenny images were found on unallocated trash space. In other words, it can be argued that a company's owner wouldn't know of its existence and that it could have been planted there by malware. A federal appellate court unequivocally declared in February 2011 that pictures found on unallocated space did not constitute knowing possession because it is impossible to determine when, where, and who downloaded them. Courts have shown an often excessive amount of empathy for the government's outrageous behavior when pursuing criminals. The fact that there's child porn involved, well, it kind of moves the needle in the government's direction. But the obstacles that the FBI has placed in its own way through its deceptive behavior may prevent it from having a case. The case is already on shaky ground with the presiding judge questioning agents, noting that several discrepancies between FBI reports and its testimony and the perplexing opposition to turning over documents to the defense as requested. In any event, it appears the FBI has a vast network of informants, paid or otherwise, working for both private companies and the federal government. Considering the FBI is already the beneficiary of legal reporting requirements, this move seems ill-advised. It jeopardizes the legitimacy of the evidence even before the FBI engages in self-sabotaging acts it appears to have done it here. Beneath all this perplexing and disturbing aversion to adhering to the Fourth Amendment, we've seen time and time again from law enforcement agencies, both local and federal levels, anything that can be done to avoid seeking a warrant, anything that leaves a paper trail behind, is employed to make sure that the accused faces an even more uphill battle once they arrive in court. Would the Geek Squad tech really become FBI informants on their own? I understand your sentiment, but I also don't buy it. If, as reported, the Geek Squad technicians company-wide are being rewarded with tips to the FBI, then it had to be coordinated by management. The FBI sure isn't going to go store-to-store with a massive chain like Best Buy, and I really doubt the techs would jeopardize their jobs by acting as informants. Well, we've talked about the need to back up sensitive and critical information, but there's another aspect that really has no absolute answer. You have sensitive and critical information on your device, and it does not start up. You need to send it out for repair. For most people, taking the device with sensitive or critical information from the unit is not an option. When we say device, it could be a computer, tablet, cell phone, or even certain peripherals. When equipment is repaired by the manufacturer or at a local computer repair shop, all your data on the device is fully exposed.
You know, Hank, you make a very good point about having, you know, a lot of personal and private stuff on my computer. I think it was last year, maybe a little bit before then, I called up my favorite repair service. That was 4G downtown. And I told them that I was having a bit of problem with the computer, and I thought it was memory, but I wasn't sure. Could they pick it up and run some diagnostics for me and give me an estimate on fixing it or replacing parts or whatever was necessary? And they said they would be happy to do that. And we made an appointment for them to come up and pick it up. And right before they got up here, I being very well aware of the problems that might be with giving my banking data and tax data and personal health data out to a service place, I removed the hard disk, and they came up and picked up the machine. Next morning, I got a call from them and said, there's no hard disk in the machine. I said, yeah, I know. I pulled it out for privacy reasons. Just put in one of the ones that you've got down there and test out the system for me. They called me back about an hour later and said, it tests out absolutely fine, no problem at all. And I suddenly realized I was being really stupid because the problem probably had to do with something on my hard disk. And did it mean my whole hard disk was dead? Just the data was dead? Now I had to start doing a whole bunch of work myself. You know, Hank, if I had followed your advice in setting up the machine in the first place, putting all of my data on a secondary drive, I would have had a very simple job there instead of a very complicated one. Now I had to clean off the hard disk, save all the material I wanted to save, try it again, replace the hard disk, replace memory. I can't tell you how much trouble I went through, not to mention that my good friends downtown gave me a pretty healthy bill for what they did for me. It's a real problem most of us don't think about. It takes 2 minutes. No, that's an exaggeration. It takes a little bit of time when the machine is brand new to set it up properly. I'd leave that up to you, really, how to do that.
What are the alternatives? Well, there are things you could do before the fact. In other words, before the equipment fails. If at all possible, store the information on a removable device, such as an SD or micro SD flash card. Store and process all sensitive and critical data onto the cloud, but understandably, there's risk and security, and most of us don't feel comfortable with that. Remove sensitive and critical data immediately after processing and by transferring it to external storage. Select equipment which data can be easily removed, even if it's not operable. And there's another option that can be used that has been made available by Microsoft, and that's the ability to install and run Windows 10 off a US flash drive so that using as a satellite or as a parasite to a regular Windows 10 operating unit, you can be attaching to the internet, peripherals attached to it, but the application and all the data stays on the USB flash drive. So if the equipment goes down, at least you have the flash drive. Now, after the fact, when that does happen, what can you do? Well, one is repair of equipment be given to someone you can trust. That's a big word, trust. In fact, T-R-U-S-T, you may not feel comfortable with that. And assuming that the data has been backed up and you have no one you can trust, destroy the equipment. New York said it was upset with Verizon for allegedly backtracking on a promise to bring Fios service to every household in the city. It wasn't joking around. The city has sued Verizon, accusing the telecom of failing to live up to a cable franchise agreement that required fiber to pass by all residences in the city by mid-2014. The company also didn't complete some requested installations, according to officials. Not surprisingly, Verizon disagrees and take issues with the lawsuit. They said that they met the terms of the agreement 100% and calls on Mayor Bill de Blasio help fight landlords who won't let them build fiber into tenants' homes. Has also proposed investing and an extra $1 billion in New York City fiber over the next 4 years in a bid to sweeten the pot, and the reality appears to be more complicated, however. Verizon's main objections revolve around interpretations of the term pass. It claims that there wasn't a firm definition of the term in the 2008 agreement and that New York City's current government is using a different definition than what two sides were using 9 years ago. The telco believes that passing meant running its fiber network alongside the same routes used for the old telephone lines, not a literal effort to reach every residence in the city. However, the lawsuit points to a 2008 Verizon statement agreeing that its fiber would have to be run past all the residence locations in the city. That sounds rather clear. The suit also notes that while there are 36,000 requests for installations at locations that can't easily get Fios, the actual number of people who can't get service is actually a lot higher. Verizon does have some strong claims, however, against the city. It notes that landlords won't always let them install fiber, and the city hasn't provided a competitively neutral letter to give to landlords when it wants access. However, there's evidence suggests that the carrier isn't telling quite the whole story. New York City had previously accused Verizon of insisting on either bulk service agreements or even exclusive agreements, which violates FCC rules to wire up an apartment, forcing landlords to accept unfair terms. If they want Fios at all, in short, while New York City case isn't airtight, Verizon can't quite claim that they are a victim.
You know, Hank, it's a very peculiar thing, this whole story about Fios. I turn on the TV on almost any station day or night, and I keep seeing a Verizon ad that if I don't have Fios, I might as well not even have TV. It's better, it's faster, it's clearer, it's sharper. They don't really talk too much about the price, but it seems pretty good when it does come up. There's only one small problem. They don't tell you how to get it. So I pulled the bill out, my Verizon bill, and I called them. Woman answered. I think she was an operator. I said, can you help me add some service to my line? She said, sure, that's what we're here for. I said, great, I want to add Fios. And there's a long pause. You can't order Fios. It's not available in your area. I said, oh, you must be mistaken. Saw it on NBC. Saw it on CBS. Fios, it's the best thing since sliced white bread. I'd like to order it. You know, about a year ago, I was spending a lot of time on Long Island with my father-in-law. He had Fios. It was terrific. I loved it. I'd like to have Fios in my apartment, please. Oh, you can't do that, sir. We don't have it. Well, that's pretty puzzling to me. I've been in business a lot of years. If I offer something for sale, I'm pretty sure that my customers expect me to have it. Now, I'm a customer of Verizon, and I'd like to have Fios. How do I get it? A couple of days later, after I spoke to this lovely woman on the telephone, I saw a Fios truck out in front of my building over on 2nd Avenue. Walked over to the driver, and I said, hey, can I ask you a question? Sure, go right ahead. I said, I'd like to get Fios in my building. He said, you and virtually everybody I talk to, and I'd like to have Fios myself at home. No can do. Most of the buildings in New York don't have Fios. There's one over there on 48th Street, I think it is, down near 1st Avenue. You could move in there and get Fios. Now, he was real nice. But I got to ask you a question. What kind of a way is that to run a business? Now, Hank, you tell me that there's a multi-million dollar lawsuit right now over failure to provide the service that was promised. And Verizon is saying, well, there's no way that we really promised that. Well, don't those folks who run Verizon ever watch television? They sure as heck promise it over on the television, on a TV set. Now, there's other people who are able to get into my building. RCN will sell me their service. Time Warner, I think they call themselves Spectrum or Special or something today. But when they're in the building, if I want to spend a little extra money, I can get them instead of RCN. Verizon is in the building, but not with Fios. You want to explain that to me, Hank? Maybe you can short-circuit the entire thing.
There was a recent article in PC Magazine on home automation. It simplistically defined it as a series of devices, such as home appliances, lights, and even security cameras, wirelessly connected to a central hub. Home automation is more than just remote control of home devices. It includes intelligent access to monitor and control basic functions of interconnected, isolated, programmable devices in your home and with the necessary security controls.
So, all right, if you go to 40yearhouse.com, you'll see the plans that we're working on for my smart house. Only, thanks to something Hank sent to me this week, I can't call it a smart house anymore. I may have to call it a smarter than a smart house. PC Mag, among other things, in rounding up what they treat as smart house stuff, says, I'm quoting, home automation is exactly what it sounds like. Automating the ability to control items around the house. Phooey. That's just remote control. If you're controlling the items, If automation is handling everything, oh yeah. Automation, unlike remote control, automation has three elements. It has sensors. It has controllers. It has actuators. If you don't have a controller responding to something it's sensing, it's not automation. And if nothing can be done about it, if there's no actuator to engage, why bother? What are you doing anyway? Here's what I wrote to the authors at PC Mag. By your definition, some of the elements of true home automation, old tech to be sure, include the coiled spring tilt switch thermostat, the clock motor driven lighting timer, the photoelectric front light control. Those wouldn't make your cut. They are controlling things themselves, automatically, autonomously, without needing a user, without having somebody on a smartphone to push their buttons to make things happen. Tell me if these things sound like home automation to you. This is part of what I wrote them, despite being absolutely disassociated from any remote control. Number one, Bluetooth beacons in the cars let a car entering the driveway open any one of many garage doors appropriate to that car with no one pushing a button. Number two, a smoke alarm triggered system turns off all fans, turns off the HVAC, turns off the natural gas feed after the generator tap, places voice calls to two fire departments, and unlocks all exterior doors. Is that somewhere in remote control? I don't hear a remote control in there. Surveillance cameras linked to an irrigation, that sprinkling system, so that watering will pause in zones that you walk onto or across. Of course, if you've got a security system, you can do the flip side of that and make sure nobody who doesn't belong out there leaves dry. And number four, responding to a leaking toilet flapper by shutting off the water feed to that toilet, but letting it turn back on whenever somebody is in that bathroom. What are you going to do? Call in from work and say, toilet, somebody's using you, go ahead? No, you can't do that. That's not a remote control application. Remote control doesn't belong there. Does a puppeteer automate a marionette or simply remote control it? Which are we looking to do? An Android is fully autonomous, fully automated. A robot could be a little of both. It's programmed, it does things, and it can alter according to circumstance. An automaton, like an old record changer, just does one thing well over and over, and it may be somewhat complex, and it may have some small adaptation, but it's not an Android. Now, admittedly, the things that I mentioned don't add up or support a magazine puff piece done to please potential advertisers in some trade-assigned category. And I said to the guys, if you have more duty to the advertisers than to your readers, so be it. I'm not one to argue with a paycheck, but maybe, just maybe, you could reword your definition a bit. Well, let's get back. Enough with PC Mag. Goodbye. I'm not reading you anymore. I've read you for, seems like, 1,000 years. Let's get back to what automation should be. Automation should be automation. Does it? You don't have to be there. You don't have to push a button. Having automation in a house, in my mind, isn't about giving you more things to remote control, adding to your little control chores. Oh my goodness, I forgot to remote control the light. No, that's not it. It's about taking those chores away. It's about letting the house handle itself. It's about making things smart enough that you don't have to be there to respond to every little change of everything. It's like, you want to stand next to the thermostat and every time it gets a little hotter or colder, readjust it? Well, isn't that what a thermostat does by itself? What are you going to do that's different? Oh, you're going to be able to control it from work. Yeah, right. Gee, I have the thermostat set for 71. I'm going to change it to 68.3. Nobody will know who did it. Oh, grow up. You know what I'm saying? You don't need to adjust your thermostat from afar. You also don't need to make yourself vulnerable to the guys who are now doing thermostat control ransomware. Whole other issue, whole other topic. The piece about the PC Mag article that I find offensive, yes, offensive, is that it diminishes all of us to being lackeys of the merchandising of products that are incomplete in their approach to what they should be doing. Really, Look, you want to buy home automation stuff off the shelf at an electronics store or buy it online. You're a grown up or you've got the money or whatever, you know, make your own decisions. Learn from them. Don't learn from them. I'm not your daddy. You know, your decision is yours. But what I can tell you is you're not likely to be happy with it later. What are you going to do? Show off? That, in fact, is why most home automation purchases are made, to show off. Hey, bud, look what I can do on my cell phone. I made my garage door open. Hey. Yeah, right. Who needs that? Well, the guy who wants to break in your garage would like it. That's okay. What do you really want to automate? You want to have lights that come on? There are all kinds of ways to do that, from switches, hey, lights on, to timers, to photoelectric controls. You can get more complex, but you don't need it. You know, one of the major companies in building a data center built it with no light switches. They just automated everything. They used mostly passive infrared to determine occupancy and vacancy, which means you need motion, but that's not terrible. So you go in the facility, lights are on when you're there, lights are off when you're not there. It knows what before and after hours are. If the room's already light, it doesn't turn on electric light. That's pretty smart. That's automation. That's a good thing. You don't have some guy sitting in a booth with a million monitors and a whole bunch of keyboards going, oh, look at the light level. Boop, boop, boop. Better turn it up. No, that's not how it should work. How it should work is without you. That's what automation is. Do it automatically. When's the last time you went down to the creek with the washboard to wash your clothes? Oh, no, you throw it in that big tub and it goes round and round, washes everything and then spins it so it can go to the dryer. That's automation, isn't it? Be even more automated if your hamper went directly to it. Be even more automated if you ever had an Android in the house to take it in. But for what it does, it's automated and you don't need to remote control it. Why do you need to remote control things? Yeah, fine. You don't want to get off the chair. You don't want to get off the couch to change the channel on the TV. And you don't want to program it to automatically change from one program, in this case show, to another. And fine, you know, that's a good remote control use. That's fine. You've got a window air conditioner or a humidifier in a room, and you want to be able to turn it on or off without getting out of bed. You know, that's not unreasonable. Could you automate it? Yeah. But if it's a $50 or $100 item, you might want to not pay another $300 to automate it. So make a choice, you know, your money. Are you going to use it wisely? You're going to use it for fun? You're going to use it to show off? Show off. Look, I can tell when there's mail in the mailbox. I can talk to a guy at the front door over a speaker there, and he doesn't know I'm not home. Yeah, well, he does. The bad guys all know by now that if it's a speaker, you're not home. Don't be taken in by the promise of being a whiz-bang Georgie Jetson kind of guy. That's not what it's about. Automation, well, you make your own decision. But in my mind, automation should be all about and only about simplifying my life. Automation is a prescription for those of us who would prefer to have fewer chores, for those of us who don't worship laziness but sure as heck enjoy it. I think that's enough for me. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. TCF 2017, formerly known as the Trenton Computer Festival, will be held on Saturday, March the 18th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the theme of the festival will be autonomous vehicles. There'll be talks, workshops, vendors, and there'll be a banquet afterwards at the College of New Jersey. For more information, tcf-nj.org. And I hope to be there, and I hope to see you. Brookdale Computer User Group will have a presentation on Picking the Best Backup Approach Thursday, March the 23rd, 7 p.m. It will be held at the Middletown Library in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC's User Group will be having a presentation on Perfecting Your Computer Backup, The Art of Backup, Tuesday, March the 28th, 7 p.m. Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on backing up your computer, Tuesday, April 4th, 2 p.m., 999 Lower Ferry Road, Ewing, New Jersey. Hey, I think I'm getting through to the clubs at least, and I hope everyone is backing up their data. And finally, the Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be having their main meeting April 7th at 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Have you talked to your wearable device lately? Wearables need a user interface just like any digital device, but it needs to be something that's easy and natural to use. A full keyboard on your wrist really is not a practical solution. So how are we going to control our wearable devices? You can have buttons, you can have dials. Touchscreens tend to be a little bit small and hard for people to manage. One solution would be speech. Speech recognition has gotten very popular. Just look at the adoption rates for Siri and Amazon Echo and other devices like that. But one of the problems here is that they require lots of power, not just energy, but also processing power. This puts a lot of demands on battery life and power consumption by the device. The Apple Watch, when you use Siri, it's actually just a Bluetooth microphone connecting to your phone, so all the work's going on in your phone. We really need something that's low power and easy to use for our wearable devices. Some researchers at MIT have developed a very clever chip. Basically, what it does is it uses almost no power when it's on standby. It's waiting for the key trigger word that will indicate that you want to give it a command. And when it hears that, then it wakes up and wakes up all the rest of the system so it can start listening. Another part of the problem is that it takes a lot of resources to figure out what's being said. One of the problems that a lot of systems have is they have to go access memory that's off the chip. And every time it does a memory access like that, that consumes more power. So this new chip, what it does is it has more data on the chip and it goes to that first. And this also saves power. Overall, this new chip could save about 90% of the power used for speech recognition for a device, making it more practical for mobile devices. So in the future, we may have some smart wearables that will actually listen to you when you speak to it. Shirts are getting smarter. Printer electronics and conductive yarns are helping make smart garments practical. But many of the devices, like the smart socks made by Sensoria, still have a rigid controller that snaps onto the conductive material, and you have to remove it when you go to wash the garment, which is a hassle and not that practical. What if you could create both the circuits and the sensors right in the fabric? Well, at the University of Cambridge in the UK, researchers have developed a smart fabric that uses just cotton and carbon. They found a way to impregnate standard carbon fabric with graphene. If you're not familiar with graphene, it's the new wonder material. It's a very strong, highly conductive, can serve as a substrate for semiconductors. It does all kinds of amazing things. It's made up of just pure carbon. It is made in sheets that are a single atom thick. So it has a lot of amazing properties. These researchers have figured out a way to impregnate standard cotton cloth with graphene, and the result is a flexible, conductive fabric. It's inexpensive, and it's made from non-toxic materials. Now, they created a prototype. They were able to fabricate electronic components directly in the material. They created a motion sensor. They discovered that even after washing it 10 times in a standard washing machine, it was still able to detect 500 motion cycles with no problem. So using this combination of graphene, carbon graphene, and standard cotton material, we may soon have wearables that are as easy to use as simply getting dressed. In 2015, falls by seniors cost Medicare more than $31 billion. That's a billion with a big B. More than 800,000 people were hospitalized due to fall injuries. Falling is one of the leading causes of death and long-term injury for seniors, and so it's a big problem. And if we could find a way to reduce the number of falls that the elderly experience, we could save a ton of money, not to mention making their lives a whole lot better. Now, one of the problems is that assessing individual risk of fall at this point tends to be a subjective process and very time-consuming. You need an expert to have a patient go through a number of different activities, and they observe them and make judgments as to whether or not they think that they're at risk for falling. Well, there's a company called Shimmer, and they have a new system. This is designed to take the guesswork out of the whole process. It's a system that includes some wearable sensors and some applications. And basically, in 5 minutes, it allows a healthcare professional to do a quantitative assessment of an individual and determine just how much they're at risk for falling. It looks at their gait, how they walk. It looks at their general mobility. And it's a proven system. It's already received CE clearance in Europe and is a registered device with the FDA here in the U.S. If devices like this can help reduce falls by seniors, it's going to make a lot of lives a lot better. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
From Joe Rujewski, another simple computer tip for busy people.
Are you hearing voices from your computer speakers, and you have no idea where they are coming from? For this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People, I'll show you how to quickly identify which web browser tabs are responsible for the disturbance. Hey, it's time for Simple Computer Tips for busy people like you. I'm Joe Rujewski, author of the soon-to-be-released Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Here's a simple, cool computer tip you need to know. Have you ever sat at your computer and suddenly heard an advertisement playing, but had no idea where it was coming from? So what do we all do? Well, if something truly embarrassing is playing, we rip our speakers off our desk and throw them across the room. But more likely, we start looking through the 20 web browser tabs we have open. We open each tab, we scroll up and down, and eventually we find the video that has been automatically playing on a website, disrupting our enjoyment of Neil Diamond. There's a much easier way to solve this mystery, Sherlock. The web browser tabs that have audio playing will have a little speaker icon in the tab. All you need to do is look at your tabs and find the tabs that have a speaker icon. Pretty cool, huh? Once you identify the tab that is giving you consternation, you can find the video playing on the web page and stop it. But there is another trick I'll tell you about. If you right-click the tab with your mouse, there's an option to mute tab. Now, if you decide to mute a tab, just remember the tab is muted, or you may be frustrated later if you actually are trying to listen to audio on that web page. If that's the case, just right-click the tab and select Unmute tab. You're able to mute tabs in Google Chrome and Firefox. If you use Microsoft Edge, there are speakers on the tabs with audio, but you don't have an option to mute the tab. And unfortunately, Internet Explorer does not display speaker icons on noisy tabs, and there is not an option to mute a tab. If you use Safari, there are speaker icons on the noisy tabs. You can toggle audio on and off by clicking the speaker icon. Also in Safari, if any tabs are playing audio, there is a speaker icon to the right of the URL. If you click that speaker icon, then all audio will be silenced in all tabs. Try this tip now and you'll never forget it. And that's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Do you have a suggestion for a computer tip? Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rujewski, over and out.
Thank you, Joe. With older dwellings, you may need to go through some form of facility renovation to accommodate new technologies. The tools providing maintenance and construction support have changed dramatically, with many boomers retiring now, and these tools are needed to be streamlined to be lighter in weight and safer to use. I asked Marty Winston to comment on this do-it-yourself trend.
How much do you know about power tools? I mean, you walk through Home Depot and say, hey, I know what that one does. I know what that one. I know what all these guys. I know what that one does. I know what. Well, I can tell you whatever you think you know. When you get into a project like our 40-year house, 40yearhouse.com has a lot of info about that. You learned more about power tools than you thought there was to learn. Now, I want to talk about the power behind power tools for a minute. Though overall, your grandparents only had one choice of power, and that was the AC power line, usually with a big, long extension cord, because the cords on the tools always seem to come short of reaching your work. In that era, professionals, notably auto garages, also had pneumatic tools powered by air compressors. In that era, pneumatic tools had a lot of oomph, a lot of punch, and having them was really no choice because you can't have power cords running everywhere, and the similar power in an electrically powered tool would have been more expensive. Now, battery-operated portable tools had not yet arrived. Halfway from then to now, from your grandparents' time to now, battery-powered tools emerged and the segment grew, but always with a consistent trade-off between the amount of power or torque or speed they could offer versus the length of time they could run without needing their batteries recharged or replaced. About 10 years ago, battery-powered and pneumatic tools could deliver more or less, you know, approximately the same amount of power and clout, so the choice became, for many people, more a matter of personal preference. Now, currently, today, battery-powered tools in brand families with intercompatible batteries and chargers had been bringing, and you've seen them, you know, like Ryobis all fit in Ryobis, but don't fit in Rigid, and Rigid all fits in Rigid, and nobody fits in Milwaukee or DeWalt or Black & Decker or anybody else. The brands are all out there. Currently, battery-powered tools within those families with intercompatible batteries and chargers are bringing full-strength power and runtime to professional job sites for an increasing number of tasks. The last holdouts, things like nail guns, are now seeing some credible alternatives in battery-powered tools. But our builder tells us, for now, pneumatic air-powered tools will always have a power advantage, and certainly, as long as the compressor runs, they have a runtime advantage. Improvements in battery chemistry are behind a lot of them coming as far as they had. But so are improvements in the tools and their motors. And to keep it all interesting, improvements in tools and compressors and so forth are also boosting the performance of pneumatic tools. Personal preference is still playing a role, but in professional spaces, we're seeing more new tool purchases happening within the major brand intercompatible battery product lines than anywhere else. Now, let's get into some specifics. I want to give some examples of cool tools, so I'm going to pick one brand. I'm picking Ryobi because they've been friendly and supportive of our house project and nice guys. Their 18-volt battery line is called OnePlus. Their lithium-ion OnePlus batteries, at least the ones we use, are 4 amp hours. That's a lot of deliverable. So with their battery, and we have a 6-battery charger, I think we have 8 or 9 of the batteries, always easy to have one handy that we need, that battery can do remarkable things depending on what it's on. Now, in the Ryobi OnePlus 2O line, again, they're all over Home Depot. Go take a look. Their LED workbench light has 2 lengths of LED emitters, one above and one below a rotating elbow. So you can fold it down short for light on both sides, or swing it up tall for a very long light, or go with an upside-down L, like on a copy stand. You push its power switch to go from none to one to the other or both. You get 950 lumens with both on, and you can run for up to 9 hours with just one on. Since that heavy battery is in the base, it's pretty easy to get stability with wherever you put the thing. Now, you guys work with electronics. Are you also working with the boxes that hold wall switches and power outlets, the 1, 2, 3 gang electrical boxes? Those are behind plasterboards, and you have to cut a hole. You have to cut a hole in the plasterboard to get it at the box. Ryobi OnePlus Speed Saw looks a little bit like one of those first-generation drivers or drills, but it has a ring up front and what looks like a drill bit, but is also kind of a side cutter. So, you know, where we used to use awls and drills and keyhole saws for that, this Ryobi OnePlus Speed Saw, it hits a no-load speed of 27,000 RPM, so cutting is easy. You put the front ring and the bit centered at one corner of what you want to cut, you're in, you start at an angle to bring it in straight, you go to the side and then take a turn and take a turn and take a turn and pop, the piece of wallboard is out and you're done and ready to mount that box. So the speed saw makes cutting drywall holes for things like outlet boxes just wholly easy. Now, the OnePlus tool we used most recently is their power inflator, which goes up to, I think, 150 PSI. It's not meant for the same heavy-duty compressor load as the thing that drives nail guns, but if you're filling balls or tires, which is how we just used it, it's 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off, and it can keep going all day. Well, I'm not sure if it's literally all day, but the battery never had me worrying about the thing running out while I was using it. It went into the spousal car, and we found four tires at around 27, 28 pounds. Just took a minute to bring all four up to 35. Off we go. Built-in hose. The battery's right there. You're not dealing with a lot of paraphernalia just to get something inflated. We absolutely love it. This is the Ryobi OnePlus power inflator using that same OnePlus battery system. They also make a OnePlus, you're going to love this, hot glue gun with the little white sticks you push in from the back. Now, this is 3.5 hours of glue flow on one of those 4 amp hour batteries. So when you want to stick things together, it's terrific. Now, let me put a footnote on that. I like glue guns for things that don't take a lot of stress. If they're sticking together, you know, maybe cloth on a board or that kind of thing, it's absolutely fine. When I'm making boxes that have to go together, I use old-fashioned wood glue. I use other Ryobi tools to make the holes for the screws and to drive the screws in, but the glue itself is squeezed out of the standard yellow bottle. The last one I want to mention is not a OnePlus. It uses, I think, a 9-square battery. It's the Ryobi hole stud detector, a little thing, a little bigger than a 100-millimeter cigarette pack. The hole stud detector has a line of 7 LEDs on it, and as you slide it along the wall, the standard stud width is roughly 3 of the LEDs. So it's very easy to find the stud, slide into it, get it centered. There's a little thing you push with a pointy spring-loaded thing that comes out the other side and make a hole in the wall so you know where to put the nail so it goes in the middle of the stud, not making a hole in the plaster. It's really cool for that. There's also an LED on it that glows red if you're over an active power line. And believe me, you don't want to put a nail into an active power line. So that's some of the stuff from Ryobi. All of the things I've mentioned are battery-powered tools. Are there air-powered versions of the same things? Yeah, probably. Do we need to worry about them? Not for the kinds of things we're doing, and brother, I'm building a house. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. Before I get a lot of email about Win to USB, which will enable you to install an operating copy of Windows 10 or 7, 8, or 8.1 onto a USB flash drive and to run with it, let me go through some of the basics so I won't be in deluge with the email. There are 4 things you have to do to prepare for this. Number 1 is you want to download the program Win to USB version 3.5. The easiest site to go to is easyuefi.com. That's www.easyuefi.com, and you can navigate to Win to USB download, or if you were to key that in, followed by // Win to USB /index.html, and that will quickly and easily allow you to download the program. There are other sources, but you get trapped into downloading bloatware and other software you don't want. The other location that you should go to also to download another program called Speedout, and I'll go through what Speedout is a little later. The website directly from the author is jalanfikus.com. So if you go to JALANFIKUS.com/apps/speedout. Now, there's two other things you need. You need the ISO file of your Windows 7, 8, 8, 1, or 10. These you can download from many of the websites, but make sure that you download a clean copy, not something that's been enhanced. And the other thing you need is, although they specify that you technically you can run on a USB flash drive, 16 gigabytes. It takes forever. I've done it. Not worth the effort. 32 is still too slow. I recommend that you buy yourself a 128 gigabyte flash drive to run with. Now, I had recommended the use of the program Speedout. And the purpose of that is if you have a number of these higher capacity drives, like from 64 gigabytes up, run Speedout, and Speedout will give you the read speed and write speed of the USB drives. Unfortunately, when you buy a USB drive, there's no way of knowing exactly what speed they run at. What you're looking for is the fastest drive for read speed, because reading is what you want to be able to run the operating system from mostly. Yes, you will have to write onto it, but that you don't mind if it runs slower. But the key is the highest read speed possible. Of course, if you get high read and high write, that's great. My recommendation is that the slowest I've run these on is where Speedout will give you a double digit in the 20s range, and you can get USB flash drive where the read speed and write speed is way above that. So when you have that, then it's simply just bringing in the program, Win to USB version 3.5, and follow the instructions at install. And this will allow you to run the Windows 10 operating system or 7, 8, 8, 1 operating systems off a flash drive. Now, the only thing I caution you on is that Windows 7 is fully functional. You have to be able to run this off a USB 2.0 drive. USB 3.0 is supported in the versions higher than Windows 7. The purpose of giving you these instructions is so that you have the ability to create an operating Windows operating system onto an external flash drive, and you can run your programs, your data, and if for any reason the hardware that you're attached to has a problem, you could take it in for repair. All you have to do is you can easily just remove the USB flash drive. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay warm, until we meet again, same time, same station next week.